I'm Dr. Howie Jacobson, and this is the Plant Yourself Podcast. Each week, I bring you a conversation with someone who's making a positive difference in the world. And for my day job, I help leaders and their teams master their mindsets so they can achieve great things. To find out more, check out the Mindset Mastery Memo, my Substack newsletter. You can find it at plantyourself.com/memo. And now, today's show. I'm Dr. Howie Jacobson, and this is the Plant Yourself Podcast. Each week, I bring you a conversation with someone who's making a positive difference in the world. And for my day job, I help leaders and their teams master their mindsets so they can achieve great things. To find out more, check out the Mindset Mastery Memo, my Substack newsletter. You can find it at plantyourself.com/memo. And now, today's show. Hey, welcome to the Plant Yourself Podcast. I'm your host, Howard Jacobson. Today, episode number 93, I talk with Dr. Sharon Livingston, who is a marketer to the Fortune 500, a psychologist, a coach, a co-founder of the International Coach Certification Academy, of which I am a board member. And in this context, she is an expert on emotional eating. And that's what we tackle in today's call. And a lot of the call is about theory, about her story. But in the middle, we do something that was quite a surprise to me. And she takes me on a journey into my own issues with chocolate. And I think it's wonderful to talk about the theory of dealing with emotional eating. What I'm hoping is that the part of the interview where I'm kind of on the couch a little bit, and she's taking me through exercises, it feels very vulnerable to me, and I decided to go ahead and share it in the hopes it'll help other people. So you get to see not just the principles of the psychology of dealing with disordered eating and disordered thinking around eating, but how actually it looks in a real-life setting. So I hope that eavesdropping will be helpful to folks. Otherwise, I put myself through quite a bit of embarrassment for nothing. So without further ado, Dr. Sharon Livingston, welcome to the Plant Yourself Podcast.
Well, thank you very much, kind sir. How are you today?
I'm very well. So I wanted to talk to you about something that has been an interest of yours and I guess a practice specialty for quite a while, which is emotional eating.
Yes, and I've practiced that many years.
Both doing it and helping people stop doing it, right?
Well, you know what happens. The thing that you know you're struggling with yourself, if you finally figure it out, you get all kinds of nice shortcuts to help other people with it.
Great. So let's share them now. But first, let's start with your own story. So people who are struggling with emotional eating right now, first of all, can you tell us how you define emotional eating? Because I'm sure there's a gamut between, oh, this piece of chocolate will make me feel good right now and kind of more extreme form. So how do you define emotional eating?
Well, that is a form of emotional eating, actually. When we're eating out of a desire to fill some need other than nutrition, it really is emotional eating. And it's not to say that one shouldn't, but very often we don't feel like we have a choice. Like there's that bowl of M&Ms in the back room of my focus group situation, and I'm dealing with a difficult client, and they're really driving me crazy. And well, yeah, I've got my broccoli, my organic broccoli, and I've got some nice organic tofu. I even have some decent seasoning, but you know, and I have it there. It's there ready for me, so that I have something to eat that's nutritious when I'm physically hungry. But oh my God, there are those colorful M&Ms, and if I take a bite of them, they're going to make me feel so much better because I have something sweet to counterbalance all the annoyance that I have to go through in that long day.
So it sounds a little qualitatively a little bit different to me than I've just had a great meal at someone's house and now they're bringing out a dessert and I'm going to have a small slice of that dessert, even though I'm maybe even a little bit full. I may not be eating for nutrition anymore. But it feels like that's different than I'm compelled to eat the M&Ms despite all this other food. Would you agree with that?
To some extent, I think there really is no reason for dessert. It ruins our digestion. It throws in all kinds of things that, you know, mess us up. You know, why are we doing that? It's not logical.
Huh. All right. So there's a bright line. Emotional eating is whenever we eat for something other than for nutrition.
Exactly. And I mean, you know, if I was a purist, that's what I would say. Now, do I never eat for just the pleasure of eating? I mean, you know, we were given bodies that like pleasure, and particularly with regard to food. And as a matter of fact, very often we choose foods instinctively because of taste. And, you know, way back before modern technology and purifying sugar from fruit and you know, it was natural to eat things that called to us and it worked. But that's been absolutely ruined in modern society because we are taste driven without the nutrition driven. It used to be a combination, it no longer is.
So that's where the emotional piece kind of snuck in. Once there was a gap between our natural taste inclinations and the foods that we evolved to eat.
For one, but there are other things as well. I mean, if you think about what you crave, you know, emotionally with regard to food, you know, like, you know, revealing my own, you know, pathology. I love ice cream. Oh my God, I love ice cream. I mean, do you have to be a brain scientist to figure out what I'm wanting?
I'm guessing ice cream?
And mother's milk.
Ah.
You know, it's on an emotional level, I like milky things. I like cream in my coffee. I like the milky, whether it's decaf or whatever, I still want the milky. As a matter of fact, if I don't have the cream in my coffee, I don't even want to drink it. So what is my body calling for?
So maternal nurturance, care, love.
Comfort, yeah. Yeah, so very often we're looking for nurturance in some form, you know, something to soothe us, something to calm us down, or something to energize us. I mean, you know, when we want caffeine and sugar, you know, maybe we're in a depressed state where we need to feel energized. And we've been conditioned through our lives that, you know, you have that sweet or you have that caffeine and all of a sudden you can do things. Now, the reality is it's doing naughty things to our bodies, but for the moment, it feels good.
Mm. Wow. So I'm here. I'm just floored by this idea that we instinctively turn to some foods on a metaphorical level.
Right.
So maybe I think like at this point, it would be really helpful to kind of get your backstory and then dive into, you know, how you came to these conclusions and what you've done with them and how you helped yourself and others.
So, you know, what's really sad about that? Whenever anybody ever asks me that question, I start hearing the, you know, the theme song for Dulcinea and Man of La Mancha. La, da, 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 da. So, well, I was the fourth child to parents who were kosher caterers. We lived in a town where they had a store, and my mother was constantly feeding people. And I was the fourth child. I was a surprise. My brothers were much older. They were already, like, you know, pretty much self-sufficient. And then she had this baby. So while she was downstairs in the store the first 3 years of my life feeding customers, I was often by myself, or I was with, you know, a caretaker, you know, I had a nanny, and I was in a way kind of abandoned by my mother. So there she's feeding all these other people delicious things, you know, all these Hungarian dishes, and, you know, they made homemade knishes and all kinds of wonderful Hungarian dishes, you know, these different apple, cinnamon, fat, sugar stuff you put in a pot and it tastes delicious and then you have heartburn for 3 years afterwards. So I went to food. My mother was definitely not only was, you know, she a mother and, you know, mothers feed their children, but she was feeding the world and she wasn't available to me. So on a very early level, I learned that food was love, not just the way any child would, but it was, you know, exponential because she was a caterer and she was feeding all these people. And I mean, it's interesting because I think that she kind of gave me over to somebody else's care when I was very, very, very young. And isn't it interesting that I like milky things? So I get comfort from milky and I get comfort from sweet. And when I went to, and my mother was an amazing, amazing cook and baker. Somewhat also from starchy things. Like, remember one time my mother said, "I'll make anything you want. What do you want?" And I don't even know. You have a Hungarian background somewhere also, right?
Well, related.
Okay. So there's a thing called a lekvár kreplach. Does that mean anything to you at all?
Lekvár is prune butter.
There you go. So there,
and the kreplach little, is like this, like rolled dough.
Right. It's made out of potatoes.
Okay.
It's potato dough. It's potatoes and flour. And you stuff it. You know, it's like a pierogi or, you know, something like that. Yeah. And you stuff it with this prune butter. And then she would put it, what they do is they drop them like dumplings into boiling water. And then she would take it out of there and coat it in butter. Melted butter with breadcrumbs.
She's like Paula Deanovitz.
I mean, it's like, can you think of anything less healthy to eat than that combination?
Yeah. Well, at least it had prunes.
Well, and which have a little value, yeah. But you know, they're mixed.
I'm joking. I'm picturing that stuff coming out dripping and coated.
But they were really, really, really delicious. I mean, just thinking about them, my mouth goes, yay, and then my stomach goes, acid. So so that's kind of the background that I grew up in. By the time I was five, I knew how to put the egg on top of the knish when it, you know, was going into the oven. And my mother taught me how to make, ceremonial bread. I was making twisted challah at age five.
So did you think you were going to go into the family business?
Oh, no. No, I just wanted to eat it. Uh-huh. So, you know, it was fun. That's how I got to spend time with her. The only way I got to spend time with her was by helping her do things, like in the kitchen, or by the time I was 11, I started working full-time to be with her. I was working full-time in their store at age 11. And at age 12, we were home and she was making veal cutlets. And the way you make veal cutlets back then, the way she made them, you know, she would coat them in this breading and then you fry them. Now, here I was, you know, 12 years old, and my mother was making them with me, and I ate, I'm not kidding you, 12 of them. Now, they weren't huge. You know, veal cutlets were, I don't know, maybe each one was about like 2 inches by 4 inches.
Yes, yeah, so maybe 3 to 4 ounces.
Each. I ate 12 of them at a time. And shortly thereafter, I threw up 12 of them. And I had never eaten a veal cutlet since then. Because it was such a horrible experience. But, I mean, that's how I started. There's some other things also. I come from some abuse and, you know, I don't have to go into a real long story about it. But between 9 and 13, I doubled my weight. And it was deliberate. I mean, not totally conscious, but it was deliberate to keep men away from me because I was terrified of my sexuality and I was just, you know, coming into it and I was, you know, brought up in this religious background where anybody who even thought about sex was, you know, a slut. And I escaped into food.
So both an armor and a keep away sign.
Both. You know, making myself unattractive. Mm-hmm. Like, who wants to be with a fat girl? So I was 13 years old and I weighed 172 pounds. And that was after I dieted for 3 days and got brave enough to get on the scale.
Were you getting messages from family members, from your mother, from other people about your weight? Or was this a solely individual private struggle?
My grandmother, who lived with us, my father's mother, would scream at me, "You're going to get as big as a house. You're going to get as big as a house." And, you know, I got called fatty and fatso. When I was in high school, I was in a, I was the announcer for Seniors Day. And my mother always dressed me in things that made me look twice as big as I was anyway. And so I was up there in this dress. I looked pregnant and all the kids in the audience were hooting and making fun of me. It was really awful. I had lost some weight when I was 14, but I couldn't maintain it. So I went down to, like, I don't know, 145, 150. And then I gained it back and I got those hoots. And then when I was 18, I lost more. I got down to a fairly normal size. I went down to about 140. And then I went back and forth. And it's only been in my adult life that I got it under control. It took a long time. I worked on myself really, really hard. I had to get to know what it meant to me, and, you know, how I was using it. And then I was able to work with my own feelings. You know, when I would get emotional or I would feel angry or scared or lost or alone or hurt, you know, really observing myself and seeing where I was going and then trying to figure out what I was really wanting. What did I really want? Did I really want chocolate? I really wanted something sweet in my life. You know, what other sweet things were there? And I started to identify what those things were. And I also figured out if I really, really, really wanted something sweet, that I wasn't going to compromise. I was going to get the thing that I wanted the most. If I couldn't get the, you know, time with my mother or time with a good friend, which was really sweet, or, you know, something like that, that if I'm going to have a piece of chocolate, it's going to be the best piece of chocolate. I'm going to wait until I'm not just rating the cocoa powder can, you know, like my Nestle's Quick or something. I mean, I could have gone and taken a spoonful of Nestle's Quick just to get a quick fix. Mm-hmm. And so I gave myself the gift of thinking, now, what do I really, really want? If I'm going to have the best piece of chocolate in the whole world, what would it be? And I would think about it. And by the time I planned how I was going to go and get it, the urge went away.
So when you first started tackling your weight in a serious way, did you start there with the emotional understanding and the self-insight and these strategies, or did you start with, you know, cruder forms of just dieting and restriction?
I was on every diet you can imagine. I was on the Pritikin diet. I was on the Atkins diet. I was on, you know, Just Eat Ice Cream diet. I was on the Beverly Hills diet. That was really disastrous because you would only eat like watermelon one day. And do you know what that does to your blood sugar? You know, here I am like 20 years old and I'm like, exit from watermelon. So, you know, you could eat an entire watermelon or two or even three. Uh-oh. That's really funny. That's my baby, Jeremy.
Okay. Jeremy has four legs and paws, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
And a monkey in his mouth.
Okay.
Better than having a monkey on his back, right?
Right. Well, as long as he's not emotionally eating the monkey.
Well, I mean, you know, I think dogs, like, out of boredom, chew things, right?
Yeah.
So there's emotional gratification that we get, even if we're dogs. It's kind of funny. I mean, you know, he cannot not chew. So, and sometimes I feel like that, you know, I need to do something with my aggression. So I want to chew something hard, or I want to chew gum. Mm-hmm. So what I'm saying is that I started doing the traditional stuff. 500 calorie diet is the HCG diet. I'm telling you, if there's a diet, I've been on it, unless it was invented in the last couple of years, because I don't diet anymore.
So what I hear is that, you know, that there's obviously in my mind a huge difference between the Pritikin diet, with which I have a great deal of affinity, mm-hmm. from a scientific and philosophical perspective, and the Atkins diet, which I think of as a dangerous, misguided thing. But it doesn't really matter how good the diet is if the driving force is these unexamined and unfulfilled emotions, then mm-hmm. the best diet in the world isn't going to work.
Well, because you can't stay on it. You can do it for a while by brute force, you know, the whole thing about willpower. My mother would tell me, you don't have any willpower. You don't have any willpower. I have plenty of willpower. However, if anyone is not dealing with the, you know, that cannonball that's about to shoot out, you know, because there's force being built up and, you know, the plunger is going back and back and back, and then it's let go and then psh, it's gone. So it's really hard to diet. Dieting itself is a hard thing. On the other hand, I eat now, you know, a very nutritious diet. It's something I've chosen. I think it's good for me. I think it's satisfying to my taste buds. And it's choice. It's a choice rather than a restriction. So it's a way of life. I believe in a way of life rather than dieting. Mm-hmm. And so it's a way of life that you make out of a choice. And the emotional drivers are going to still come up. And we need to figure out what to do when they do.
Right. I think, you know, for myself and for a lot of people, there, it's hard to discern around food addictions in terms of being purely physiological. Mm-hmm. You know, so if we're used to eating all the donuts and the salty stuff, and certainly coffee and other foods that are known to be chemically, biochemically addictive, and so the diet people from my camp, or, you know, rather the healthy eating people who agree that this is a lifestyle, it's not a short-term diet, they say just stick with it, and we bioadapt, and within some weeks or months we downregulate our taste buds, and so broccoli and tempeh and tofu start tasting good, whereas before they were very bland. And I think that's absolutely true, but there's also this emotional part that doesn't get downregulated unless you address it.
Right. And, you know, I used to have a sugar addiction. And, you know, part of that was emotional and part of it was chemical, right? It's biochemical. And somebody told me that the reason that we want to eat sugar so much on a physiological level is that when we eat sugar, we create yeast, little yeast cells in our body, and that the yeast actually tell the brain to tell you to eat sugar. And so I saw this yeast invasion as an army that was fighting me, because I know yeast is not good for you. And I knew a lot about yeast reactions in the body, and it made me angry. And I remember really clearly, I remember where I was living, and Glenn and I were together. We'd probably been together about 10 years. And I said no to sugar and to white flour, to the things that created yeast. And I did it all in one fell swoop. And I had 3 days of intense cravings. I didn't have a headache, but the cravings were like, but I was angry at the yeast. And I thought, I'm not letting anything control my body like that. So I had to take control of my anger and target it in a healthy way against the problem. And that was how I got, there's like 72 hours to get over the intense craving. And then, it's weeks before you start to feel comfortable. And then it's amazing how natural sweet things taste so wonderful. Same thing with salt. And I'm sure you know this, if you taper down salt, all of a sudden you taste the natural flavors in food. I love kale. I could drink kale juice every single day. And I love it. It tastes good to me. I love broccoli. It tastes good to me. Coming from eating, apple, cinnamon, sugar, oil, and fat, and carb. I don't even know what she called it. Maybe she called it a kugel. But it was, what's that guy's name? There used to be an old Jewish comedian. His name was Buddy Hackett.
Sure.
So he said that when he left home, he thought he was dying because the fire went out.
It was his mother's cooking, right?
He'd been living with heartburn for his whole life until he left home. It's pretty funny, actually, because unfortunately I could relate to it. And I didn't have it all the time, but boy, that, high acid producing stuff that my mother made, and she'd make these, coffee cakes, in the old traditional way. And, my mouth liked them. My mother invented a chocolate cake that was so rich that, like a 1-inch piece of it was like eating, it's almost like eating fudge. So, and it was her own recipe and it was handed down, all of her grandchildren have the recipe. I don't have it. And I didn't want it. So
you mentioned that, you kind of went through an understanding of emotional eating, and you mentioned a few of the techniques you've used, getting angry at the yeast, asking yourself what you really want, refusing to compromise. When did you get to a place where you felt like you had the upper hand?
So it took a long time. It took years of my own, analysis and therapy, my own, to understand what was driving me. And, having to sit down and ask myself, what do I want? What do I want? Okay, I want a bagel. Okay, what does that remind you of? Well, it reminds me of, there were a number of years my mother worked in the best bagel store in South Jersey. And what was it about that? Well, she'd bring home a big bag of bagels, and they were hot and they smelled delicious. And we would sit around and we would joke, and I could put butter on it or cream cheese, mostly butter. And I felt filled and satisfied, warm, really happy, being at her table, and relaxing, because my mother was not one to relax. I get that very honestly. I'm like 24/7 workaholic, and she was like that. And so those were times where she was a little bit more relaxed and I got some attention along with, the bagel. The same thing with pancakes. Like, Glenn will notice that when I'm missing my mother, I'll say to him, boy, I wish I could have a pancake. And I don't eat pancakes. I haven't eaten a pancake in forever. Huh. But I'll get a desire for a pancake.
So it's funny that you mentioned pancakes, because, in my sort of whole food plant-based community, one of the big efforts from a lot of chefs and doctors is to try to make the transition seem normal. So one of the things we would do is, like when you said, I haven't had a pancake in years, I say, well, I can think of 10 healthy pancake recipes. We could use buckwheat flour. We don't have to use oil. We could use chia seeds. It's just off the sweet potatoes instead of egg. There's a dozen things that I can think of off the top of my head that I've seen. Go, Jeremy. On my Facebook, posts page. But it sounds like it's a little bit different to try to substitute, that maybe you think that's less effective if it's the pancake itself that is carrying the emotional charge?
So, you know, it's a combination. I think it's really, really good to have alternatives. I had protein bars, like for, I found a protein bar that I'm comfortable with in terms of its ingredients, and I've read up a lot about it, and it's sweet. And that seems to work for me personally. So I think it's good to have substitutions that, you know, that are healthier. But if I was being a purist, I would work a little bit differently. And I could give you an example. Like, so Howie, if there was one food in particular that you crave that you might not think is the best thing for you, what might that be?
Well, chocolate.
Okay. So what kind of chocolate are we talking about?
You know, anywhere from Valrhona, Kaya Butt, Maison du Chocolat, down to that spoonful of Nestle's Quick.
Mm-hmm. You know. And so,
I mean,
tell me about...
I'll get it out, you know, any way I can. So I'll find a healthy recipe that has some chocolate chips in it, and I'll have a bag of chocolate chips in the house that will be singing in a tone that only I can hear, apparently.
Right.
Or, you know, I'll go to Trader Joe's and I'll go, oh, look, here's this mostly healthy cereal. First ingredient is oats, but it's like chocolate clusters. So, you know, any which way I can justify it.
And would you be willing to work with that a little bit?
Oh, sure.
So take a trip down memory lane, and I'd like you to go back in your mind to a young, positive memory with regard to chocolate.
Okay.
And tell me how old you are, where you are, what's happening.
Well, it's recurring, but let's say it's around age, you know, 6 to 9.
Mm-hmm.
So my mother used to buy chocolate, and she would hide it around the house.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't get the sense that she had a huge problem with it. You know, I hung on her apron strings. So I always, whenever she went shopping, I went shopping with her. Like she wasn't, I'm sure she wasn't sneaking, you know, dozens of bars. And, but, you know, she liked to have a little bit of dark chocolate. And, you know, in those days, there wasn't a lot of variety. You basically get Hershey's or Nestle. And we got Hershey's. And there was, you know, special dark and regular and crackle. And occasionally, and she'd get these bags of the little miniatures. And I knew, after a while, I knew where all her hiding places were. And sometimes she would, you know, have me go get one. And we would share it together kind of secretly.
Tell me about that. Tell me about what it was like when you would go get it and you'd share it secretly. What was that like? What were the feelings? How did,
yeah,
you know?
Well, it felt like she was trusting me with a secret. It felt like when we were doing that, she wasn't yelling at me for anything. You know, she's sort of a stern Austrian lady with a lot of opinions. And through most of my childhood, looking back, I would say that she spent a lot of time sort of criticizing and nagging and following me around and telling me what to do and clean up my room and this and that. And it wasn't a very, you know, there was always something to be done. It was like, you know, being on the deck of a Prussian warship where there's, you know, if you're sitting around, certainly there's a deck to be swabbed somewhere. And so these moments when we're just sort of enjoying a semi-guilty pleasure, because it was, you know, we knew it wasn't great for us, but it was a pleasure. And I think for her, she could relax and taste a little bit of the sweetness of life. And, you know, she was a Holocaust survivor, had moved several times in her life. And I think it brought her a little bit of sort of respite and peace to have this little piece of sweetness in her life.
And it brought you.
And it brought me into a relationship with a mother who wasn't a drill sergeant.
And so if instead of having, you know, a piece of chocolate today as an adult, you could be with someone where you felt, you know, trusted and having a little bit of a special moment, who might that be that you could do that with?
Well, certainly you know, my wife, my kids, just a, you know, a quiet moment where nobody's requiring anything of anyone, when we're just enjoying each other as we are.
And how could you set that up so that when you're having that craving for chocolate, that you might possibly consider having a moment with your wife or one of the kids or all of them?
Mm. Well, we'd have to talk about it in advance because everyone's got schedules independent of my own. So, you know, I'm getting this picture of, you know, picking up the red phone and shining the bat light into the sky. Like, you know, Abba's having an emergency. Come be with him unconditionally. Otherwise, he's going to eat some chocolate chips.
Well, what about that? What about having a bat phone?
It's a challenge because, you know, another piece of that story is that when I started eating healthy, I kind of dragged them along with me and I became very judgmental. So I think there's still a lot of unfinished emotional business around, you know, they still feel like I judge their food choices, and I probably do. So I think it's a complicated thing.
Well, what if instead of saying, hey, bat phone because I'm going to have chocolate, what if it was bat phone, hey, I'm aware that I need a little sweet moment with the people I love the most? Yeah, maybe a minute.
Well, that's worth a try.
And what do you think would happen if you did?
I think I'd have a lot more sweet moments that will mean something, right? The chocolate that I eat doesn't mean anything minutes afterwards. You know, it's like my relationship with chocolate is like a series of cheap one-night stands.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, I mean, what if you could even...
I feel bad afterwards.
Right. Like you've been had.
Yeah. Is this all there is?
You know, you were talking about kind of like making memories also. What if, for example, when you made a series of, you know, quick little recordings, like 1 minute, 30 seconds, a snippet with a talk you had with your wife or something you shared with your child or, you know, one of your kids, and you have them. So when you have that urge for the chocolate, you play that message. So you've got your bat phone and then you've got your, you know, recording.
All right, I'm going to try it.
What do you think would happen?
Well, I mean, partly I'm skeptical that anything replaces chocolate. But in, you know, my hope would be that it's a shortcut to what I really want. Whereas the chocolate is a two-dimensional false promise, but this is the real thing. And so the chocolate craving was really a craving for something deeper that I figured out what it is and I satisfied it. So the chocolate craving doesn't need to exist anymore. It doesn't need to be fulfilled.
And that's kind of what I've noticed happens with people. But let's say, oh my God, I can't get a hold of anyone. I'm not near my iPhone, so I can't listen to the recording. I'm not near my computer. I don't have it with me. So let's imagine here you're wanting chocolate.
Okay.
And if you're going to have it, I want you to have the best experience you possibly can. What might that be? If you're going to get the very best piece of chocolate, what would it be?
Okay, so it would be like a $3 truffle, like the size of a grape, from probably, you know, Belgium, or a, you know, there's a raw chocolatier in my town who sources fair trade organic ingredients from all over the world and put stuff together, you know, so something made with exquisite skill and love.
Oh, I love that.
Also, you know, so much of chocolate is caught up in slave labor and unfair trade practices. So I would want to know that the chocolate I'm eating has caused happiness and love all along its supply chain. So I wouldn't be happy eating something that I could trace back to a slave plantation on the Ivory Coast.
So how would you go and get it? So tell me what time of day it is that you're having this craving. Where are you? And let's see how we can solve it.
Okay. Well, can't do it today because our driveway is our sort of 10th of a mile long driveway is a sheet of ice. So even I am not so desperate to risk life and limb and car to go out today. But let's say it's some evening. It's 7 o'clock and I have an interview coming up at 8 for the podcast. And I'm starting to fade a little bit and I don't want to eat a ton more food. And I'm here in my office. I've got my mason jar, my water jar, and it's empty. And I don't really feel like walking 18 feet to fill it up. And I'm like, oh, I've had a hard day. I wrote a half a chapter. I deserve, you know, I'm just going to go get myself a bowl of cereal right now. And maybe everybody's out. They're all out at a function because they know I'm recording and they don't want to be worried about tiptoeing past my office and making noise. So I'm home alone and I don't have time to go out to a store, but I've got this craving. So let's say that's the scenario.
And so you don't have time to go out to the store. So is there a way that you could prepare for these moments knowing that they will happen? Is there some way you could prepare?
So I could try to have some of this stuff in the house. I'm concerned that I wouldn't treat it well. You know what I'm saying? That it would be gone and I'd be thinking about it all the time. Like the idea of sanitizing my environment means that I wouldn't have it in the house.
Well, where could you have it? You could still get it, but it wouldn't require going as far as going to the raw chocolatier.
Okay, well, I could try to store it at a neighbor's house, but we've only been here for 6 months. I don't think I want to let them know how weird I am just yet. Mm-hmm. We have a chest freezer in the mudroom. I could kind of store it I have a box, like my grandparents' old metal box with a skeleton key sort of thing in it. So I could put it at the bottom of that in the key, and I could hide the key somewhere up on the crawl space or under the house. Mm-hmm. Like I could certainly make it a challenge and a treasure hunt to get this stuff so that it would take me, you know, a good 5 minutes to get it into my mouth.
And so would you be willing to wait a whole minute before starting that 5 minute?
I say so now.
So I think that's a really good idea because after that 1 minute, if you really want it, I want you to go and have it.
Okay.
But in that 1 minute, think about what I'd like you to do is think about what's going on, what feelings are being triggered, you know, what it reminds you of. Is there anything else you could do in that period to get some of that sweetness and that energy that you would feel good about? Mm-hmm. And then if you still want the chocolate, go and have it. How much would you need to have?
Well, let's say if I took one out, if they're frozen solid, I mean, it's going to take me a little while to get it down anyway. So let's say one. And, you know, really enjoying it, especially if it's frozen, it'll melt in my mouth. And so the flavor will kind of explode as my taste buds get, you know, melt and warm the substance.
Mm-hmm. And so would that be acceptable on some occasions to realize, oh, maybe I don't really need it. I can save it for later. Or I really do need it and to have that one. Would that be acceptable? Would that be an acceptable alternative?
Yeah, well, it's certainly better than what I do now.
Good. Good.
Okay, so any guidance about the conversation when I'm feeling, you know, that minute? I'm just asking myself, what do I need? What am I feeling? how else can I meet those needs?
And if I had the ideal thing that I'm yearning for, describe it in as much depth to yourself as you can. And where would you get it?
So you're saying that, like, the act of fantasizing vividly about whatever chocolate, this perfect chocolate, could actually trick my brain into thinking I've had it?
There's something satisfying about going through that exercise. I guess maybe it's that, but it's also giving into the thought rather than the action, and then thinking through whether or not you want to take action.
What I feel like is different about this, and it's starting to make perfect sense to me, is that my initial reaction would be to resist the thought, which creates tension. It makes me feel guilty for having the thought again, for being so weak, and it's kind of fueling the very process that leads me to want chocolate.
Exactly. Very well put.
So really, it sounds like the centerpiece of dealing with emotional eating is, it's kind of a peace talks.
Yeah, that's great. And, you know, the crave food could be different at different times. People tend to have their particular ones. Like, for example, with Glenn, it's pizza. He gets these fantasies about pizza. And we'll actually work through, you know, where would he get the best piece and, you know, exactly how was it made and, you know, to imagine what it smells like, the texture, the taste, what it's like taking a bite, going down. And by the time you go through that, it's almost like you ate it.
So isn't there ever some part, like I'm imagining there's some part of me that would be like a voice in my head going, I don't want to do that. I just want the chocolate.
Right. And so there's no, you know, there's no magic bullet. You have to do a little bit, and the little bit is just pausing. It's just pausing. The pause is the most important thing.
Why is that?
And you know, and helping yourself. Very often it turns out when you ask people about this, they're missing something from a relationship. And sometimes it's with someone who's, you know, past that you can't even have that relationship. But who would be like that? Who might that be? And how would a conversation with that person be? Or what would it be like to go to the movies with them? Or and to get a fix from another, because it's usually something about nurturance that was missed, some form of comfort, nurturance. It might also be texture. So, for example, if I am really craving, sometimes what I'm craving is softness, and my house is filled with soft materials. Like right now, we're getting a rug clean because one of the dogs had an accident, and I've got this really scruffy, ooky $25 rug on the floor at the moment just because I can't stand not having any kind of texture. But I would rather have fleece, soft, you know, like pillow-type furniture. I have a Tempur-Pedic bed. I have down, you know, pillows. I've got the softest blankie you can imagine that touches my body. I don't use a sheet under it, so I have to clean my blankets more often than, you know, most people, because I won't put a sheet between. But it's soft. It's so soft. And it's almost like, you know, cuddling up to a soft mommy. Mine always come back to my mother, so because I didn't get enough of her when I was, you know, an infant and stuff. But so sometimes it's a texture in your life that can change things.
Right. Well, you know, you mentioned about sort of chewing and being, you know, angry and wanting to crunch. I remember reading somewhere about food scientists and packaging scientists for, you know, like Nabisco and General Mills and big companies like that, figuring out the ideal crunch point for a chip and how hard you have to pull to open the bag to kind of evoke these very primal sort of hunting and killing aggression impulses.
Right, the tension released from them. Exactly. And did you ever eat a soggy chip? Oh my God, that's like the most frustrating. Like, ugh, why bother?
Yeah, no. When the tortillas get stale or soft, they go in the oven until they're crunchy again.
Or they go in the garbage can, right?
Yeah.
So there's a, I forget what his name is, Brad's Chips or something. Do you know the kale chips?
Yeah,
these
Brad's,
are,
yeah.
The ones that come in the bag, not in the box. There's like a plastic box.
Uh-huh.
The ones that come in the bag are really chips.
Okay.
And they've got a great texture, and they're great for hummus. Oh, my God, they're like the best. So those satisfy my need to crunch. And, you know, what are they? They're kale. It's just dehydrated kale with some flavoring.
Right. So it sounds like there's a – we don't have to deny all of our emotions. It's okay to sublimate some of them with food if we, you know, choose foods that serve us. But also to recognize, it sounds like that every one of these cravings that I guess I and most people I know view as kind of curses – are really doors to a kind of a deeper relationship with ourselves.
Oh my God, yeah. I mean, you could use this just by itself to fully analyze yourself. Like your whole story. You know how like they say a dream is your whole lifetime? Uh-huh. Well, your food choices of the moment tell a whole story about what you're going through. It's really a fascinating kind of study. And since food is nurturance on all levels, it gives us clues about how to take better care of ourselves and how to give ourselves love.
Wow. Do you also deal with not just the quality of the food, but sort of the quantity and pace at which we ingest it? I know a lot of people, you know, in my community eat the right stuff, but they eat too much of it. And they eat it too fast, and by they, I mean me.
Well, and what was interesting, yeah, I do, and I didn't have to do it directly with you because you did it naturally. You talked about one piece. You really wanted one piece. You didn't say 10.
Yeah,
you said
one. I'm also on the air, so.
Quantity comes up naturally in the discussion. Uh-huh. Most people don't say, well, I need a whole bag, you know, giant bag of chips.
Right. Well, and I guess it goes to, I can't remember the source of the quote, but something like, you can never get enough of what you don't really need.
Oh, I love that.
So that if I'm eating M&Ms for a feeling of a sweet life or ice cream for maternal nurturance, there's no amount of M&Ms or ice cream that is going to do the trick.
Exactly.
This is fascinating, and I didn't realize when we arranged this call that I was going to get a bonus session for myself. So I guess that's the
very fun.
I don't mind making it public if it helps other people. But speaking of which, so do you work with other people who have these kinds of issues?
Oh, sure.
So tell me a little bit about that, about how you know, you're up in New Hampshire, so I assume you work remotely with people.
Well, there are people who live in New Hampshire. Yep, I work in person and I work remotely. You know, I was brought up in a tradition of doing coaching, counseling on the phone. And so I've been doing that for a long time. Even when I do market research, which is my other hat that I wear, a lot of it is remote. So I'm very, very comfortable remote. There's something wonderful, actually, about working remotely, which is sometimes when you're in person, the client, especially when they're talking about something uncomfortable, about giving up a bad habit or considering a new way to treating it, they feel scrutinized. Because, you know, the coach or the counselor or the therapist is looking at them. And even if the coach is looking with the most loving eyes, we bring our own perceptions of how people see us, and it's uncomfortable. Whereas on the phone, you know, we're comfortable on the phone or on Skype because we've been talking on the phone to people since we were 1.5 or 2. Hi. You know, mommy put you on the phone early on, you get to say hello to your grandparents and cousins and stuff. And so we are accustomed to being on the phone. It's comfortable. Whereas if you have to go to somebody's office, you know, there's a whole other dynamic that comes into play, which is not necessarily comfortable. So I am a big proponent of doing work remotely, a big proponent of webinars and Skype and telephone calls for the comfort level. And of course, I do see people in person, and we do training in person. So if people want to get in touch with me, I can give you a phone number where they can reach me.
Sure, that'd be great. And if there's any, you know,
I can send them to a website as well.
A website or anything, you know, I can post things in show notes as well. But I'm sure there's lots of people listening to this who, you know, would like some help and guidance and can sense the freedom that's possible. Not just, you know, the freedom from the problem, but a much greater freedom. You know, Joseph Campbell says, "Where you stumble, there lies your treasure." So I think people who are listening to this are getting a sense of the huge treasure that's available in what just looks like a pit.
Right. And it's not like an olive pit or a prune pit.
We're back to the Lekvar, huh?
I haven't had Lekvar in probably like 20 years. Oh, my God. I wonder if they make it, you know, like, is there some natural Lekvar without sugar? Wow.
You know what? If I can find it online, I'll post a link just so people can
know what it is.
So how can they find you?
Sure. They can call my cell and then, you know, leave a message and I'll get back to them. 603-505-5000. And they can go check out my site, emotionaleatingsecrets.com.
All right, well, I'll post those. And for people who are listening here, that's emotionaleatingsecrets.com. That's pretty memorable.
Good.
And thank you again. Thanks for taking the time. Thanks for my my impromptu therapy session. I have to say right now, I have no craving for chocolate whatsoever. So
that's what happens. That's what happens. You know, like Glenn did it with me because, you know, as you know, Glenn's a psychologist as well. And Glenn, my husband, and he, it was about the bagel. And I went hunting in my mind's eye and went hunting through every possible bagel store in New Hampshire. Getting a bagel in New Hampshire is not the easiest thing to get, you know, a really good bagel. And by the time I was finished, I had no desire to eat a bagel. I had satisfied my craving just by thinking it through.
Well, that's awesome. That's,
And that doesn't always happen. That's why, you know, if you're going to have it, have the best one. Have exactly what you want on the plate you want it on, in the situation you want it on. Take a few minutes and fully enjoy it.
Mm. Well, because I assume that sort of taking care of yourself is a meta message, right, to your subconscious. That, okay, you know what? We're okay here. You're going to get the nurturance you need. I'm not leaving you all alone.
Exactly. Well said.
Well, Dr. Sharon Livingston, thank you so much for taking the time to join us on the Plant Yourself podcast.
Really, really fun. And I love Plant Yourself because, you know, it's a way of nurturing and growing ourselves. I love it.
Right on. All right. Thanks a lot and talk to you later.
Take care.
Bye-bye. I hope you got a lot out of that interview with Dr. Sharon Livingston. And if you want more from her, you can find it at emotionaleatingsecrets.com. Just a preview, I have just launched a health consulting service, and you'll be hearing more about that in the days and weeks to come. But basically, it's a combination of giving people access to good information about health so that they can move away from the medical model of treating symptoms of disease and take charge of their own health and move toward true wellness. So again, more on that in coming weeks. Next week, I talk with Karen Page, author of The Vegetarian Flavor Bible. And there's a lot of connections that you'll hear between that interview and the one you just heard with Sharon. As always, if you feel like supporting the show, please share it on social media. Tell your friends about it. Leave a comment and a review on iTunes. And there's always a spot for donations to help the hosting and to pay for my time as I go out and find the world's most interesting people to interview about planting ourselves on this precious planet. So, as always, be well, my friends. Let's take this home with some gratitudes. First of all, thanks to Mama Earth. You have been so very, very good to me. Second, Will Ridenour donated the use of his beautiful song Sabali Dawn as the theme music for this show. You can find out more about Will's music at willridenour.com. Third, thanks to all the patrons of the Plant Yourself podcast for your financial support. You can read the names of all the patrons at any show notes at plantyourself.com. If you would like to become a patron to show your gratitude for the work I'm doing and help support it, you can do so at plantyourself.com/gift. That's G-I-F-T, all lowercase. And finally, I want to thank you, the listener, for making all of this possible, for giving me a reason to reach out to people, to have conversations, to edit, produce, publicize all the stuff that I do is for you, so that we can continue to have conversations and continue to ripple out healing and transformation into the world.